It seemed like years since I'd been in the comfortable surroundings of the consent. But here on this ledge, I'd gone into a daydream where I could practically see my Fras and sewers in front of me and hear their voices. From Arcibald, Leo, and Jessery, I moved on to the decidedly more enjoyable image of Ayla. I was fancying her at Tredegar, a place of which I knew little except that it was older and much bigger than St. Edhar, and that the climate was better, the gardens and groves lusher and more fragrant. I had to interpolate a fantasy wherein I survived this trip, found Orlo, got back to Tredegar, and was allowed in the gate as opposed to being thrown back or spending the next 5 years with nothing except the book to keep me company. Having got those formalities out of the way, I conjured up a half-waking dream of a fine supper in a rich old Tredegar refectory, at which Fras and sewers from all over the world raised glasses of really good-tasting stuff to me and Ayla for having made those pinhole camera observations. Then the daydream took a more private turn, involving a long walk in a secluded garden. This made me drowsy. It was not turning out as I'd expected. Whatever part of my mind was in charge of daydreams was shaping this one to comfort me and lull me, not to arouse passions. A shift in the sledge's attitude brought me just awake enough to know I'd been sleeping. In going over the pole, we had followed a stocky isthmus. Two tectonic plates had collided in the far north and pushed up a range of mountains that would have been tricky to pass over if they hadn't been buried under 2 miles of ice. During the last day or so, the continent had broadened beneath us, but we had stayed to the right, or, now that we were southbound, western side of it. Not all the way to the edge, for the western coast was a steep subduction zone mountain range. There was very little level ground between it and the frozen sea, and most of that was covered in treacherous crevasse-riddled glaciers flowing down from the mountains. So instead, the sledge train stayed some miles inland of the coastal range, tracking across a plateau with stable ice. That's where the sledge port stood. Roads ran south from there across ice, tundra, and taiga to connect up with the transportation network that ramified all the way to the Sea of Seas. But the first outpost going that way was hundreds of miles distant. Smugglers, such as the man driving my sledge, could not prosper carrying their passengers such a long way. Instead, they veered to the right or west, bypassing the sledge port and taking one of 3 passes that slashed through the coastal range to connect with ports on the shore of the ocean. These were reachable from the south via icebreakers. Cord, Saman, and the Crades would simply get into the fetches and drive south from the sledge port. If the weather had been better and the short-range smugglers had been operating today, I could have paid one of them to whisk me around the sledge port and drop me off on the road a few miles south where I could simply have climbed aboard Yule's fetch. Instead, my 4 companions would drive south without me for a couple of days into a more temperate zone, then swing west and cross the mountains to a harbor called Masht, the home port of the icebreaker fleet. In the meantime, I would buy passage on an icebreaker or one of the convoy ships that followed in its wake. This would bring me down to Masht. Once we'd rendezvoused there, it would be only a few days' drive to the Sea of Seas. So what I was doing now was Plan B, Plan A being the short-range whisk-around, and frankly, we hadn't discussed it in very much detail because we hadn't expected it to come out this way. I had a nagging feeling that I'd made the decision hastily and probably forgotten some important details, but during the first couple of hours on this little sledge train, I'd had plenty of time to think it through and satisfy myself that it would turn out fine. Anyway, when I sensed the sledge changing its attitude beneath me, I took it as a sign that we were beginning the ascent to one of the 3 passes that connected the inland plateau to the coast. According to Saman, one of these was considerably better than the other two, but was closed by avalanches from time to time. The sledge drivers never knew, from one day to the next, which one they would end up taking. They made up their minds on the spur of the moment based on what they heard from other smugglers on the wireless. Since our driver was in a separate vehicle, sealed up in a heated cab, there was no way for me to overhear his wireless traffic and get any sense of what was going on. A few hours later, however, the sledge's velocity dwindled and it shambled to a halt. We passengers spent a minute or so learning how to move again. I checked my watch and was astonished to learn that we had been underway for 16 hours. I must have slept 8 or 10 of them. No wonder I was stiff. Braj hurled a tent flap aside to flood our sledge with gray light, bright but directionless. The storm had broken. The air was free of snow, but clouds still screened the sky. We had paused on the flank of a mountain, but the surface beneath us was reasonably level, some sort of sledge track, I guessed, that traversed the slope through whatever pass our driver had decided to take. Braj showed no interest in getting out. I got to my feet and made as if I were going to climb over his outstretched legs, but he held up a hand to stay me. A moment later, we heard a series of thuds from the sledge tractor, followed by a peeling and cracking noise as its door was pushed open through a coating of ice. Feet descended steel stairs and crunched on snow. Braj lowered his hand and drew in his legs. I was free to go. Only then did I remember Saman's warning not to let my feet touch the surface, lest I be abandoned. Braj, who seemed to have done this before, knew it wasn't prudent to venture out until the driver had exited the tractor.